Well, it's springtime in the valley on Magnolia Lane.
The Masters Golf Tournament, a sure sign of spring. And we're going to talk about golf this hour on the Ideas Network. John Munson in for Joy Cardine. Joy will be back on Monday. The 1975 Masters Golf Tournament was a real cliffhanger, a back-and-forth battle between some of the real heavyweights of golf of that day. And Gil Capps has written a book about it, titled The Magnificent Masters, Jack Nicklaus, Johnny Miller, Tom Weisskopf, and the 1975 Cliffhanger at Augusta. He joins me to talk about that and to discuss the game of golf in 2014, what's happened since that Masters tournament. Gil Capps, welcome to the Ideas Network.
John, thank you very much for having me. You mean it's not springtime yet in Wisconsin?
No, it's on the calendar, and in parts of Wisconsin it may be, but where I live, we got 10 inches of snow yesterday, so it'll be a while before the covers come off the greens and I can put my sticks in the trunk of the car again. You've worked in golf media your entire year, so your entire career, I should say. So tell us, what's the appeal of the game for you?
Wow. You know, I kind of played golf off and on growing up. I was more of a basketball guy, but I really got the golf bug actually when I spent a year of college over in Scotland, and particularly at St. Andrews, which is the home of golf. And I think what really pulled me into the game was there really is a spirit about it, and a spirit about playing golf when you're playing over there on these ancestral links, where the game started hundreds of years ago. It's one of those things you really can't explain. As with most things in life, something you're very, very passionate about, and when you gain that passion, it's kind of something that's inexplicable. But I think there are a lot of things other things with the game that I enjoy as a golfer and being in the golf media. It's really a game that you're testing yourself and you're seeing, how well can I do playing this game? It is just me and this little white ball there in front of me and this big golf course, and there's a pretty simple goal to try to get that ball into the hole. And it's a lot like life. There are a lot of challenges to try to do that, and in some holes you can do it in the amount of strokes you're supposed to. Others, there are certain obstacles in front of you where you don't get that score that you want. But golf is a game of a lifetime too. It's a game you can play your entire life. So those are a few of the aspects of golf, I think, which I treasure.
Well, the Masters Golf Tournament is an event that even non-golfers tend to pay attention to. What is it about the Masters Tournament that makes it stand out? I mean, there are a lot of really great golf tournaments, but the Masters seems to really jump out.
It does, and I think in my book, that's one of the things that came up that was one of the layers, that the Masters Golf Tournament, from the beginning, it wasn't really necessarily supposed to be considered the best golf tournament in the world. It wasn't created to be that. It was created as this invitational golf tournament in Augusta, Georgia, that was going to benefit this new club that was co-founded by Bobby Jones and possibly help sell a few more memberships during the Great Depression. And what it turned into, instead over the years, is a signature sporting event, one which you ask almost any sports fan, give me the five things you'd like to do on your bucket list of sports, and I guarantee you probably 75%+ are going to have the Masters Golf Tournament probably in their top three or top five. I think it's the overall appearance of that golf course on TV, and the fact that every year it's at the same place, it's at the same time, and it has a reputation of having great finishes on that Sunday afternoon on these holes that are so familiar to people, and having great champions. And I firmly believe that aura that the Masters has now really can be traced back to 1975 and what happened on that Sunday, because everything that happened on that Sunday is what now we think the Masters should be and what we almost come to expect it to be every April.
Well, and that is, I mean, that was a great moment in golf. It was a great moment in Masters history. Why did you decide to write a book about it?
The easy answer is, believe it or not, one had never been written on the 1975 Masters. But obviously, to get to that point, I've been in golf all my adult life, and you know, I've kept hearing about the 1975 Masters from players, from other folks in the media, from guys who said, you know, that was really the first Masters that I remember. That was the Masters that really got me interested in golf. And of course, knowing history, you know, well, that, you know, Jack Nicklaus, that was, you know, the Masters he won, and he holed this great putt on the 70th hole. The 16th hole, that final round, that a 40-footer up a hill across this ridge, which people thought was an impossible putt, but there has to be a little more to it. And so I thought that you know, having this great golf major, and we've had so many great books on the sport and books that have chronicled almost every other great event, that I thought this event was well worth exploring.
And there were you talk about the title of your book has the three players, Jack Nicklaus, Johnny Miller, and Tom Weisskopf, who were the lead actors in that Sunday. But there were some terrific golfers in that tournament, and you tell their stories in the book as well. And we want to hear all about those. I'd like to invite our listeners to join in at this point. Are you a golf fan? Did you watch the 1975 Masters tournament? And well, what do you remember about it? Will you be watching this year's Masters? Do you even play golf? And what is its appeal for you? Or if you don't play golf, are there reasons why you don't? If you have questions about the Masters, about any of the golfers that we're going to be talking about, please join us at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Talk@WPR.org is the email address, and you can join us on Facebook. Look for the Joy Cardine Show and leave your comment or question there. Gil Capps is my guest. He's the author of The Magnificent Masters, and he's one of the creators of the Golf Channel's editorial research unit. We'll be back to talk some more about the 1975 Masters in just a moment. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Well, it's springtime in the valley on Magnolia Lane.
Well, the swallows can return to Capistrano and the vultures can return to Hinckley, but for many of us, the real sign of spring is when the Masters tournament comes on television. Most of us don't get to go there and probably never will, but we wish we could. The 1975 Masters tournament was a tremendous golf event featuring a suspenseful back-and-forth battle on the final day between the three of golf's heavyweights of the time. And Gil Capps, who is one of the creators of the Golf Channel's editorial research unit, has written a book about it titled The Magnificent Masters, Jack Nicklaus, Johnny Miller, Tom Weisskopf, in the 1975 Cliffhanger at Augusta. Let's talk about those three golfers that you mention in the title of your book. Of course, Jack Nicklaus has won more Masters tournaments than anyone else. Johnny Miller won a lot of tournaments and has gone on to a very successful career as a golf commentator on NBC. Tom Weisskopf, a tremendous golfer, probably doesn't get as much credit as he deserves for what he accomplished in the world of golf.
He absolutely doesn't. And I know recently there was some news made about some changes to the selection criteria for the World Golf Hall of Fame, and I certainly hope that Tom gets his recognition, as I think he rightly deserves to be in that Hall of Fame. But you know, if we go back 39 years ago to that 39th Masters, if he's the victor that Sunday afternoon, I don't think there's any question that he would have been in that Hall of Fame a long time ago. And you know, John, I guess you know somebody would ask, well, what? You know, what actually made that Masters so special? It was these three gentlemen, and I think any time in sports that that the general public gets excited when we're watching, you know, the best of the best in that sport going head to head, and whether that's in football or baseball or tennis or basketball or whatever, when you have the stars of the sport all aligned and then playing as well as they ever have, and going down the stretch competing with each other, that is quite a rarity and quite a thrill. And that year, those three guys with, and I temper that by making apologies to guys like Gary Player, who one of the greats of the game, Lee Trevino, both of those guys competing in that Masters as well. But these three gentlemen in April of 1975 were the best three in golf. They were the hottest three players in golf at the time, and they were the three guys who were the favorites in the Las Vegas sports book. So in golf, it's a little different than most sports, because golf is you can have an off day or an off week, and there are a lot of good golfers, and you have a field that year of 76. You know, anybody who kind of steps up to the plate and plays well can win that tournament or any tournament any given week. So to have the top three guys all still there on Sunday afternoon and battling it out, and for a storyline to play all the way to the last couple holes with those guys, it's really, if you look back in the modern history of the game of golf, it's the only time that's ever happened. It's kind of like if we were to come here in 2 weeks of this next Masters, and all of a sudden it's the final nine holes, and we have Tiger Woods and Phil Mickelson and either maybe an Adam Scott or Rory McIlroy all right there on Sunday afternoon, all within a shot of the lead, back and forth, and somebody makes a great putt. I mean, you can imagine, you know, the reception and the ratings that an event that a day like that would garner in the sports world, and that's actually what happened in 1975.
So what was it like to watch that year's tournament? I mean, we talked about the Jack Nicklaus 40-footer on the 70th hole. We alluded to that earlier. But what were some of the other more riveting moments from that tournament from your perspective?
Wow. Well, you know, people in this day and age, too, when we have, wall-to-wall coverage of everything, and we have, basically almost 4 hours of coverage on the first round by ESPN, and CBS has on the weekend. We have Golf Channel all week with news, and we have internet and everything going on. It's hard to believe back in 1975 there was no coverage of the first round, no live coverage of the second round. Saturday, the third round, CBS doesn't come on the air until 4:30 in the afternoon, 4:30 to 6. And then Sunday, they don't come on the air until 4. With their first camera being on the 12th hole, so you only have 3.5 hours of live coverage of that event 39 years ago, which really is hard to believe. But I think that's the other thing that made the Masters special at that time, because you knew you weren't going to get that much coverage, and so you made sure you tuned in at 4 o'clock to watch. But that event that year, it really was Weisskopf's tournament probably to win. He played for 72 holes, probably the better golf than the other two. Weisskopf in that final round, was really in control until the 11th hole, and that's when he hit an approach shot in the water on 11 and made a bogey. And that's also a hole where Johnny Miller missed a very short putt for par. That was kind of a turning point that led Nicklaus kind of back in it and kind of gave Nicklaus for a slight bit control of the event. But really, what happened toward the end there, the crucible, which I talk a lot about in the book, that putt that Nicklaus made at 16, and the fact that it was Miller and Weisskopf who were standing on the tee right behind him, having to watch the greatest player of the game make that putt in front of them, and kind of, especially for Weisskopf, to have to put a tee in the ground and kind of face his demons after trying to chase Nicklaus his whole career to kind of try to reach him and try to topple him and get on that pedestal at the top of the sport was quite a moment.
And how did that tournament affect the sport of golf? That the 1975 Masters. Did that change things? Did that make us more excited about the game? Did it lead to increased coverage? How did that affect the game of golf?
You know, I think it affected it in two layers. In three layers for golf. So I haven't mentioned yet that this Masters, you know, really 51 weeks before the event even took place, it was always going to be a memorable Masters because Lee Elder had won an event in Pensacola, Florida, and thus qualifying to earn an invitation to the 75 Masters, and he became the first black player ever to play in that tournament, which had been it caused quite a stir over the previous few years, not having had an African American golfer play in the Masters. So number one, that question, even though race, and we've had other issues in the game since then, at least that question wasn't asked anymore, and the sport and black players like Lee Elder could move on. Number two, the three gentlemen, I think it affected them quite a bit. I think with Nicklaus had not won a major the previous year. He was in his mid-30s, and he really, for that event, had to try to rededicate himself to get back and really secure his spot as the best golfer in the world, and he was able to do it. And obviously, as we look back now 39 years ago, if he doesn't win that, it's 17 majors instead of 18, and 17 is a much better number to look at for a guy like Tiger Woods. And with his recent struggles, that's his goal, to beat Jack Nicklaus's major championship record. You know, for the other two, it was, you know, I'd say it was the end of their careers, but it almost was for Johnny. He was kind of on the downswing after that event. He thinks maybe it took a little bit out of him. Maybe if he would have won that event, which would have given him, at the end of his career, three of the four majors, it may have propelled him to work a little harder, to do a few more of the things he should have been doing at the time, to keep his place amongst the best in the world. And obviously for Weisskopf, it really, at the time, devastated him. He finished runner-up in the Masters four times, and to this day, he thinks back to that tournament and that day a lot. That was his to win, and who knows what it would have done for those two guys, confidence-wise. And I think that's one of the things, especially Nicklaus thinks, that those two guys lacked confidence. And if they could have won that day and beaten Jack Nicklaus. And Jack understood that, I think, because Jack understood these two guys are the most dangerous guys. They're the two guys that have, as Johnny likes to say, they had the most horsepower under the hood at that time. And so it was significant in what it did for those three. And then finally, I kind of mentioned that it was very significant for the Masters tournament in general. You know, the Masters tournament, which began 80 years ago, this invitational tournament in Augusta, Georgia, and what it had grown into. By 1975, it rivaled all of the other majors. But I think that afternoon, and when you had more than 15 million people watching across the nation and watching on this glorious sunny afternoon and watching the best three players, competing in such a thrilling climax, and having Jack Nicklaus win, this is what now everybody talks about the Masters, and I think their model of what it's like on a Sunday afternoon, what every Sunday afternoon should be at Augusta National, is 75. It's the best players in the world. It's thrilling shots, dramatic conclusions, and this really was 1975, I think, set the standard and set the bar with which we expect every Masters to be. And you know what, more often than not, the Masters delivers on that.
You talked about the confidence of Jack Nicklaus. Was that what set him apart from other golfers? What was it that made him such a great golfer?
Confidence and competitiveness. Absolutely. The only other player I think who ever approached Jack and his will to win was Tiger Woods. Those two guys, winning is everything. And now Jack handled losing a little differently than Tiger. But Jack did have a confidence in himself, and Jack had. You know, also he had a game plan, which I think is one of the interesting things that when I did the book, you know, we think of Jack Nicklaus being this great player, but Jack was also a pretty conservative player. You know, he played at that time the percentages and did what he thought he needed to do to win. John and Tom didn't necessarily do that. They didn't necessarily think in those terms. You know, they played the game, I believe, more to see what they could get out of the game.
And we're going to have to hold that thought and come back and pick that up on the other side of the news. We're up against a hard break here. Gil Capp stays with us. We're going to talk more about the Masters in just a moment. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to this program on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay tuned.
It's you that I love. It's you that. Well, it's springtime in the valley.
In just a couple of weeks, Augusta, Georgia will be the scene, and Augusta National Golf Course will be the golf course where the Masters Tournament is played. We're talking about that this morning with Gil Capps, one of the creators of the Golf Channel's editorial research unit and author of The Magnificent Masters, Jack Nicklaus, Johnny Miller, Tom Weisskopf, and the 1975 Augusta Cliffhanger at Augusta. And Gil Capps, we had to stop in the middle of a thought there at the news break, but we're talking about the fact that one of the things that made Jack Nicklaus such a great golfer was that he was such a great course manager. He played the percentages and seemed to be picking the right shot. Johnny Miller, Tom Weisskopf maybe took a few more chances, and that was one of Nicklaus's advantages.
That was one of his advantages. I hate to equate it to kind of the superstar, maybe a superstar basketball player who, you know, he all he wants to do is win, and no matter how the team wins or what he does, winning is number one. To, you know, the guy on the team who likes the feeling of scoring a lot, or the feeling of maybe playing the perfect game and everything going okay, and the score winds up wherever it winds up, even if they lose by a point, it's not okay. They want to win, but it's, you know, they've kind of accomplished their goal. And John and Tom were a little like that. I was saying that Johnny had the comment, you know, he kind of plays hot and cold golf. He'd rather play hot some of the time than just play lukewarm, you know, all the time. So, and Tom had a little bit of that too. There was in the 70s, there were some guys out there who played, for the style, played because of the style, and thought that it was ball striking. It was kind of looking good. It was playing golf, you know, the right way. Was important, and probably even more so than winning. To Jack, you know, if it required, if you went out there and told Jack Nicklaus, hey, you have to play golf with. I can guarantee you that if you play golf with ladies' clubs and with a pink ball and, you know, and go around with a 10-foot long putter, but you're going to win, he would do that. It was whatever it took to win. But Jack also, too. Jack, I think, sometimes he played the percentages maybe too much. There were a few times where he didn't take enough chances, because this was a man who finished second in major championships 19 times, you know, while winning 18. So, but more than not, you know, the one thing is that Jack Nicklaus never beat himself on a golf course and never gave away that edge that he had over other players in the minds that they had, that Jack was the greatest, and they knew that Jack wasn't going to beat himself. And that was a big advantage Jack had, and it was kind of the same advantage that Tiger Woods had until recently, and Tiger seems to have lost that edge, where Jack, you know, his entire career, he never lost that edge that he had.
Well, he went on to win more Masters tournaments after the 1975 cliffhanger. That seemed to be Is that golf course, was that just suited for his game, or why was he so successful there?
Augusta was very much suited for his game. You know, Jack, when he came out and turned professional, was the longest hitter in golf. And Augusta National is a golf course at that time which really favored guys who could hit it long, especially to take advantage of the four par five holes they have there at Augusta National. Jack could reach all of them in two shots, which made it a lot easier to get his birdies on those holes, and that's where he did a lot of his scoring. But it also, Jack hit the ball high, which as time went on, Augusta National became more of a high ball hitter golf course.
Explain why that's important. Explain why that's important for the non-golfers in the crowd.
Well, that was important at the time, and especially in the mid-70s, because you have to remember the equipment back then was a little different than it is now. Technology has made lots of advances in golf equipment. It's much easier to hit the ball high and to stop the ball for professional golfers, even if they aren't necessarily a player who can throw the ball up high in the air. But at the time, with the green, with the balls and the clubs and the greens at Augusta National, which were actually a Bermuda grass greens, which were warm season grass, and they were overseeded with a cool season grass. These greens were very firm, and so to be able to get the ball to stop on the greens, you had to hit the ball high. So there are very few players who could do that. But the three best at hitting it high were Jack Nicklaus, Tom Weisskopf, and Johnny Miller. And Jack was also, it really is a golf course where even though it's kind of open off the tee and it looks like, you know, it's fairly simple, you know, it requires a lot of strategy where to put your ball on certain sides of the fairway so the hole will open up so you don't have to cross hazards or bunkers. Where to put the ball on the green, or where if you're in a bad spot, where to miss it. And Jack, with his course management and, of course, his putting, Jack, when he seems to, we look back and think every time Jack Nicklaus had to make a putt on a green, he made it. And most people still think that Jack Nicklaus overall probably was the best putter the game has ever seen. Not necessarily because of any technique, just because, you know, the focus and the fact that just seemed that he could will putts in the hole when he had to. All of those things gave Jack an advantage at Augusta National, and in fact, Augusta National, too. It's a golf course where the more you play it, I think the better you play it, and that's still the case in this day and age. We don't see many people go there and have a lot of success in their first attempt or their first couple attempts. And so by that time in 1975, Jack knew that golf course, you know, like the back of his hand, so to speak.
Augusta National has had its share of controversies over the years. You mentioned Lee Elder played in the 1975 tournament. That was the first time a black golfer played in the Masters, but a black players had been barred. There were no black members, I believe, until 1990. They admitted their first female member in 2012. How do you think that whole thing affected the public's perception of golf as a sport?
You know, that's a hard question to answer because, you know, obviously I'm inside the golf media, so I probably have I'm looking at it through different glasses. But obviously, to the average person outside of golf and outside of sport, it's not. It probably didn't look favorably upon it. In golf, there are other sports too, but golf in particular, even going back to when the game first came to this country, has had not a very good record at times of being inclusive. And obviously that includes women, that includes other races and religions. I think at this time in the game, however, I can't think of any other sport really that's more inclusive, except for certain private clubs. And private clubs are, as we know, with other organizations, outside of golf, They're able to have to set their own rules and boundaries. Obviously, the big problem with Augusta National in that respect was that this is, you know, the spotlight of the sport of golf is on this club, you know, every year. And the fact that it's the first major of the year, and now in many people's minds, it's the most important and the biggest major of the year. And for that to be a private club and to then have issues with not having either a black member or until recently a female member was a big problem for the general perception for the game outside.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we got some callers who want to join the discussion. You could be one of them at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. For those of you who don't play the game of golf, do you pay attention to the Masters? Are you curious about it at all? Does it have any impact for you, even if you're not a golfer yourself? And if you do play the game of golf, you know, what does the Masters mean to you? What do you think about when you see those pictures of Magnolia Lane? 800-642-1234. Gil Capps is my guest. He's one of the creators of the Golf Channel's editorial research unit, and he's author of the book The Magnificent Masters, Jack Nicklaus, Johnny Miller, Tom Weisskopf, and the 1975 Cliffhanger at Augusta. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Well, it's springtime in the valley on Magnolia.
Springtime means time for golf courses to open up, at least at this latitude. There obviously are places in the United States where they're open almost all year. But one of the things that's a kind of a harbinger of spring is the Masters Golf Tournament in Augusta, Georgia. Probably a lot of people who don't even play golf or are otherwise interested in it watch at least part of the tournament on television. And the 1975 tournament in particular was a real cliffhanger. And Gil Capps has written a book about it titled The Magnificent Masters. We're talking about that and about golf this hour on the Ideas Network. Let's go to the phones. Luke in Appleton is with us. Luke, thanks for joining us today.
Good morning, John.
Good morning.
Pleasure to talk to you. I'm a pretty big fan of golf. I've played a lot of golf over the years. Sports in general. This is kind of analogous to like Dick Weber and professional bowling back then. I just love to watch Dick Weber and Dave Davis. But what got my attention is the guests in the 75. I don't remember that particular tournament, 75, but when you mentioned that 40-foot putt of Nicklaus, that's my memory of Nicklaus in general. If you mentioned Jack Nicklaus, I just think, you know, I don't have to go to the beach, you know, and be hypnotized. I just think of this winding, curling right, curls left, gets in. It's almost like the Badger gets in, straight in, you know. Oh, man, Nicklaus was so amazing. And I was wondering if the guest has any other memories of Nicklaus before 75, after, of Nicklaus making these, like, 100-foot putts, you know, curve back, curve left, and just amazing, as I'll never forget it.
Hey, well, Luke, thank you very much for the call. You're right. That's the, you know, the iconic image, and what is still for people who even if they don't really remember that year, which hopefully they'll remember a little more now that we have a book on it. But they remember Jack making that you know, nearly impossible putt. And Weisskopf likes to tell the story that a few years after that, they went back out to that green. CBS wanted Jack to take the putt over again and try to make it. And Jack hit putt after putt after putt and didn't come close to making it again. That was how hard that putt was. But the other thing I think why it sticks in people's minds, you know, Jack was pretty stoic on the golf course. You know, he never let a bad shot get him down. He never really, you know, maybe he'd have a little shake of the head or, you know, as I like to say, you know, the only cuss word you really heard Jack Nicklaus say on the golf course was, you know, you'd say, "Ah, Jack," you know, that was his way of kind of expressing displeasure out of shot. So he never really got down, nor did he ever really get high. You rarely saw a lot of emotion from Jack. You know, there are only really two instances, I think, where you see Jack do something have something happen where he's out of character and expressing great joyous emotion. The first time I remember was when he won the 1970 British Open at St. Andrews, a few months after his father's death, in a playoff over Doug Sanders, and he holds a putt on the 18th hole and throws his putter straight up in the air. That was very uncharacteristic. And then 75 Masters, 16th hole, when he makes the putt and he leaps in the air and throws his arm up in the air and he trots off the green. That's very un-Nicklaus-like, and I think that shows how tough that putt was and how much he knew that putt meant. And also at the time, you know, he never looked back to the 16th tee at Tom and Johnny. But he knew those guys were watching, and as he told me, you know, he knew when he made that putt, you know, those guys, in particular Tom, were going to have a hard time with their next shot.
Luke, thanks so much for the call. Golf has obviously evolved over the years. You talked about the improvements in equipment that allows even golfers like me to keep the ball in bounds most of the time, and certainly the demographics of golf have shifted over the years. It seemed to really peak in popularity in the early part of the first decade of this century. Maybe not having the best of times over the last few years. What are the demographics of golf these days?
You're absolutely right, John. It seems like golf, the participation numbers that the National Golf Foundation puts out peaked just before this Great Recession, a little over 30 million, you know, about 2005, 6, 7. It's dropped off to about 25 million now. You know, they're more, I think, across all socioeconomic backgrounds, and I'll expand a little bit upon what I talked about the previous segment. I mean, if you go to a public golf course in this day and age, you know, you're able to see, you know, people of all ages, male, female, you know, all races playing the game of golf. But golf, you know, like of other things now in this day and age, there are issues with getting people into the sport and people staying in the sport. And, you know, golf is very good at forming task forces. There was another one recently formed, and I joked to a person, you know what, soon we're going to have to, in golf, have a task force to study the task forces. the two big problems to me, it seems like, in the game of golf, number one is the cost associated with playing it. Look, we were trying to figure out if you really went out and got a new set of golf clubs retail that were kind of not necessarily right at the top of the line, but pretty close, got outfitted with everything that you needed, and then we're going to go start lessons and start playing, you know, you're looking at dropping, you know, at least $2,000 just to get started in the game. Now you can do it for a lot less than that, but this is, you know, we're talking about getting going kind of the right way. And then you're going out and playing golf courses and playing, you know, public golf courses this day and age, which were built recently and built, you know, let's face it, to make money. And it's not just golf, but when money enters the equation and everybody's in it to make money, it does change the sport a little bit. I will go back to a town which I'm familiar with is Charlotte, North Carolina, and I assume that this has been an issue in other metropolitan areas around the nation also, that you know, there was a boom and there was a public golf course boom. A lot of public golf courses were built, but we also had the old-timey public golf courses, the places that I call the blue-collar golf courses, where you go and play and you'd have you know, you'd have no bunkers and you'd have you know, pretty rough greens, but these are places where you could go and pay, you know, $10-$15 and play golf, and you didn't feel like you were holding people up, and you could knock it around. You could kind of learn the game, and a lot of those places were in cities where the land became, you know, more valuable than just having a golf course on it. So I know in Charlotte, a lot of these golf courses closed down to where now, if you want to play the game of golf and start the game of golf, you're really going right out to a new, you know, public golf course where now your green fee is probably closer to on a weekend to $50, It's one where you have to take a card. It's one where you have bunkers everywhere and water hazards, and it makes the game pretty challenging. And also, those kind of golf courses also take more time to play. Slow play is a little bit of a problem in golf, with everybody, with time, with more things, more work hours and more things you can do. And I know with the family and work, it's tough to get out and play. It's tough to get out and say, you know, I can dedicate, you know, 4+ hours to go play golf this weekend. But that's a factor, too, of some of these golf courses that were built. So, to me, time and money are the two biggest deterrents to playing the game today, and we have to somehow overcome that to get more people, playing the sport and enjoying the sport. So it's a great sport for a lifetime, and it's one I think, though, really, that it comes down to golfers, getting golfers into the game. And I think if you have somebody that's playing golf, you know, and you want to help the sport out, you know, grab a buddy who doesn't play, you know, help him or her learn the game of golf and take somebody under your wing and serve kind of as a golf mentor toward a friend and show him or her this game for a lifetime.
Well, I wouldn't mind mentoring someone in golf as long as they didn't try to copy my swing. That would be a really bad idea. This year's Masters, we're getting close. Those of us who are really into that are getting pretty excited about it. Tell me, what can we look forward to at this year's Masters tournament? And who are you watching? Who's your pick? Who's your pick to win this one?
You know, this is one of those Masters this year, John, where it's going to be going in probably as wide open as any Masters I can remember. And I say that from the standpoint of the guys all at the top of the world golf rankings. None of those guys have played real well this year. And a couple of the guys who have played well, like a Rory McIlroy or Adam Scott now, have had an event here in the last month where they've kind of been in control of it on a Sunday afternoon and have pretty much given it away. And a couple of guys are injured. Guys like Phil Mickelson, who is actually down here in San Antonio this week, who haven't been playing real well. I think it's wide open. But the thing is, at the Masters, as I mentioned a little earlier, it is a golf course where you have experience is a big key, and it's a place where I think Lee Trevino mentioned this in my book, that it's probably the easiest major to win for good golfers.
Okay.
It is a limited field. And so I think... And
we're going to have to leave it there because we're out of time. I'm so sorry. Gil Capps, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
You're welcome, John. Thank you for having me.
The book is The Magnificent Masters. Thanks to Christy Taylor for producing this program. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network.